financial crisis of the euro and pushed the financial system of Europe to the brink of a meltdown several times in order to force these governments to do what they wanted. So they got an additional 2 years or more of recession than we did, even though the United States was the epicenter of the world recession and financial crisis of 2009. We had a recession that lasted 18 months, and then the economy started to grow again. They had a similar recession, but then they went for a double dip after that, and I argue that this was a direct result. And they, of course, they have more than twice the unemployment today in the Eurozone than we have here in the United States. And I argue that this is a direct result of these authorities actually using and therefore having to prolong the crisis to implement their political agenda.
Well, do they really expect that this policy will lead to some kind of recovery and further growth? I mean, see, so obviously self-defeating, but, you know, there are some people who feel that what's happening here is that some of the fat cats of Europe are picking up bargain properties from countries like Greece when they have to, sell off state properties. Is that happening, you think?
Oh, yes, that's happening too. But, you know, I think and this is a view that's common among the left, that this is driven by, the greed of bankers trying to collect debt and squeeze these countries. I think that's not the main part of the story. In the case of Greece, for example, the creditors would have been much better off, with some very small debt relief and having the European Central Bank do what a central bank is supposed to do, which would be to guarantee the sovereign debt, and make sure that their interest rates didn't go sky high and their debt didn't spiral out of control. You know, it was in 2010 when they signed their first IMF agreement, the debt, public debt of Greece was about 130% of GDP, and now it's closer to 180. It's not payable. There's going to have to be another restructuring. There was already a restructuring that cut the principal held by the private creditors by about 50%. So they lost a lot of money that they didn't have to lose through this austerity by making everything worse. So you can't really explain it. I mean, you could make the argument that the creditors as a class, as a group, want to punish this country to make sure that there aren't future defaults. I think there's a little bit of that motivation there. But I think that you can't really explain it in terms of the bankers trying to make money. They really lost a lot because of this deepening and prolonging of the recession. And I would say other corporations and businesses also lost from the prolonged recession that they didn't have to have. So it really is about social engineering, I think. It's about changing these countries and using the power that the Eurozone authorities have. That's why we didn't have anything like this in the U.S. You know, if Mitt Romney had been elected, he might have wanted to do some of these things too, but he also would have wanted to be reelected. And so he probably wouldn't have been vastly different on these questions of austerity and macroeconomic policy than the Obama administration, no matter what he wanted to do. And for ideological reasons. But in Europe, these people have a free rein because they're not elected authorities. And so, 20 governments committed political suicide rather than leave the Eurozone.
So this is this is a way of getting these things done without sort of going behind the voters or going over the voters' heads. Would you say this is sort of a continuation of what Margaret Thatcher did in England?
Yes, it's very similar, actually. And it's, I don't know if I'd call it a continuation, because there hasn't been, a continual process of this, but in Europe, But it is it's certainly the same. It's the same kind of project. Yes, absolutely. It's even worse in some respects.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to me that in your book you say that the crisis was originally in Europe was caused by private overborrowing and not by government overspending. Can you talk about that some more?
Yes, that's one of the many ironies. So it really was, if you look at the public finances of all of the, weaker Eurozone countries or the victimized Eurozone countries, except for Greece, you had, all of these countries had sustainable debt burdens before the crisis. So it wasn't the public sector that was over-borrowing. It's the private sector that over-borrowed. And when their bubbles burst, like the real estate bubbles in places like Spain, or just the overall bubbles, financial crises in, in the whole world economy, including the U.S., that's when the economy shrank, and that's when you got the public debt burden became a problem for two reasons. One, because when the economy shrinks, you have lower tax revenues automatically, and you also have certain expenses go up, like welfare and unemployment insurance. And so that's what pushed these countries into deficits. But then, of course, the austerity made all of that worse, and so that's how they ended up in trouble. It wasn't because they were overborrowing in the run-up to the crisis. It was the private sector that was overborrowing.
Is this austerity, or is somehow the corporations kind of taking it out on the public and using the public to pay off their debts? Is that happening?
Well, that already happened. There's no doubt about that. The basically public monies in Europe were used to bail out the banks so that most of the debt that was formerly held by the banks, the sovereign debt that was formerly held by the banks in these countries, is now held by public entities. So the taxpayers definitely picked up the tab.
Wow. You'd think there'd be more people, a lot of people out in the streets over this. It's a wonder there aren't more.
Well, there have been, and there has been political upheaval in Europe. Mm-hmm. You did get, for example, a left government in Greece. Now, of course, they ended up surrendering under extreme pressure, but nonetheless, it was a huge, it was a political upheaval. A party, the PASOK, the Socialist Party of Greece, which, had 40% of the vote or more for 40 years, dropped to less than 6%. Okay, so these were massive upheavals, and the same thing in Spain is happening right now. There's an election coming up, and it's the center-left parties. In the case of Spain, it's the PSOE, the Socialist Workers' Party, has fallen to 15% in the polls. That was another one that was like the Democrats or the Republicans in the United States. And so you have this in a number of countries. You've had real political changes, in real shifts, a collapse of the center-left. Some of that, unfortunately, at least in Spain and Greece, more progressive forces, newly formed parties, like in Spain, it's only less than 2 years old, Podemos, picked up most of what the center-left lost. And, of course, in Greece, it was the left party, Syriza. But in other countries like France, it's the far right, the fascist right, that is getting a big chunk of the support. So, but nonetheless, you do have political upheaval as a result, and it's kind of a result of this structure of the Eurozone, where you have taken away from the people from the governments the most important macroeconomic policies. First, you know, monetary and exchange rate policy with this central bank that is not really a central bank for these countries, it's supposed to be, but they don't play the role of a central bank for these countries. In fact, they've done the opposite in many cases, actually weakened these economies when they should have helped them, like our Federal Reserve did, you know, in the United States in the Great Recession. So you make these changes, and then it becomes very difficult politically for these politicians to get out of it, to get out. They have to leave the euro. And that's difficult for many reasons, which I can explain if you want. I'm not excusing it. I think they should have left. I think Syriza should have left. But if you look at it politically, you can see how difficult it is for them to actually leave the euro and do what they need for the economy to recover when the European authorities won't let them actually do it within the euro.
Well, I read an article by Ellen Brown about how the banks, you know, that, you know, they can just sort of turn off the tap and just sort of bring Greece's economy to a screeching halt. And so, in other words, you need a bank or something for almost any kind of economic transaction.
Well, that was the central bank of the, not the private banks, but the Central Bank of Europe, which is like our Federal Reserve. That was an example of, if you look at when Syriza was elected, January 25th, the left party in Greece, the central bank immediately cut off the main line of credit to the Greek banking system. And then a couple of months later, when the government, the left government, was challenging them and decided to hold a referendum on whether to accept the further austerity, then they cut credit to the banking system so much that they had to shut down the banks, which was, you know, this is a huge blow to any economy. So again, this is something that I don't think any central bank has ever done in history. The central bank is supposed to be the lender of last resort, like our central bank is, you know. And this is the opposite. They actually deliberately sabotaged the economy in order to try and force the people to vote, to vote yes. And of course, they voted no. By 60% majority, which was a shock to everyone, and so that's the kind of blackmail situation that Greece was facing.
Okay, this is Fight the Empire, special hour-long edition, and we are talking to economist Mark Weisbrot about his recent book, Failed. And if people want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. So I wanted to ask you, what is it? How can people fight back against this?
Well, I'm glad you asked that about, you know, because if here in the United States we have something that we haven't had ever, I think we have an organized movement. It's called Fed Up. You can find it on the web, and they've actually had some influence in the media that's trying to make sure that our central bank doesn't raise interest rates and actually, you know, slow the economy and raise unemployment, which is what the Fed has traditionally done. You know, all the recessions prior to the ones caused by the stock market and the housing bubble bursting in 2000 and 2008 or 2006, respectively, is when the bubble started. The housing bubble started to burst. All the recessions in the post World War II period before 2000 were caused by the Federal Reserve raising interest rates and pushing the economy into recession. Now, they didn't always do that deliberately, but they were deliberately slowing the economy, and they were deliberately throwing people out of work. So now we have, for the first time, I think, ever since the Fed was created, in the early part of this century, the last century, an actual political movement and a debate over whether the Fed should raise interest rates. And I think that's very, very important for anybody who cares about, you know, any kind of social and economic progress. Because when they do that, they throw people out of work, they raise unemployment, and then wage growth is slowed, and of course the inequality is worsened, and inequality by race is exacerbated because African Americans, for example, have twice the unemployment rate of white people, and so that's exacerbated as well. So this is a key policy that people have generally not really paid attention to. You know, they just think the media reports it as well. You know, the central bank's doing its job; they have to make sure that inflation doesn't get out of control. But here we are with inflation is almost zero. And there, it's been below their target for more than 6 years, and there's no excuse for raising interest rates. And so, this is one of the things I think that people can do, and it's already having an impact in the sense that the Fed is delaying this rate increase. Part of it is public pressure.
Well, we do have a caller on the line. Joe is on the line. Morning, Joe.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question that's not quite aimed at what you've been specifically talking about, but I'm curious if your guest can talk about what has happened in Iceland and give a little bit more background as to how that got the ball rolling back in 2008. And then I think there was just some legal ramifications recently where I think over 40 of the bankers in Iceland actually got convicted and are probably going to serve some time. So can you comment on that and talk about, I think Iceland also had an opportunity to win in one of the European courts and not have the country back the debts of the bankers. So all of that I'm curious about.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I haven't followed the criminal prosecutions, but in terms of the economics, Iceland was an example of, first of all, in the run-up to the crisis, they had an explosion, an enormous banking system, explosion of financial bubbles and overlending and borrowing and, and this burst. And they did recover, of course, much better than the other, the weaker, the more vulnerable Eurozone economies, partly because they were able to devalue their currency, and they also didn't bail out the banks, say, the way Ireland did. They were able to, so they used different policies than the Eurozone did to reduce the austerity and recession and have a much quicker recovery. That was the most important thing, I think, that economists drew from Iceland's experience.
Well, I think
just a short follow-up there. It seems like the Europeans did lean on them pretty hard to try to get the country to back the losses to the investors,
foreign investors
that were outside of Iceland. So
right.
It seems like, and then that got resolved in the country of Iceland's favor. So there was a lot of pushback from Europe, and they lost, it seems.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Okay, thanks for that call. Do we have another caller on the line? Mitch is on the line. Morning, Mitch.
Thank you very much for opening up a discussion that we don't have often enough, because it seems to me that the subject of, first of all, I appreciate you mentioning, Mark, the fed-up movement about the Federal Reserve, because I'm hoping it's a bit more substantial in the way Federal Reserve sort of gets thrown around on online and in progressive journalistic circles, where it's almost used as a security totem, the way that Benghazi is among the Tea Partiers. People talk about Federal Reserve conspiracies, and there's never any demystification of what the Federal Reserve has to do with, for instance, say, all these so-called free trade agreements that have been losing deals for every country that has signed them. The outcomes have been shown to be failures for the 99% and benefiting the 1%, and yet there is a rush not only to sign new ones, like the Chorus FTA, the Korea-U.S. one in 2012 that Obama passed, that nobody even talks about in the run-up to the new Asian Trans-Pacific partnership deal. Now, Mark, can you clear up why it is, first of all, that no journalists will analyze Chorus FTA, except for this one website called Economy in Crisis, and oddly enough, the mainstream business magazine Forbes, which totally trashed the deal. But nobody else will even mention Chorus, as if, and Obama gets to go on press conferences saying, well, we should end our fixation on NAFTA because we've made great progress in trade agreements since then, and his 2012 one has tripled the imbalance of trade with one country alone, Korea.
Yes. Well, it is interesting that it's gotten so little press. I can't really explain. I mean, you know, the media is generally supportive of these agreements, and so they don't pay attention to those things. I mean, it has changed some in the TPP debate. I think this has been a different debate than the others, because you have seen the media, a lot of it at least, acknowledge that it's not really about trade or free trade. There's been a lot more discussion about the pharmaceutical, for example, patent and copyrights extending.
And why Doctors Without Borders took out full-page ads to fix the TPP.
Yes.
But nobody holds up the Chorus as a clear 2012 example of what would happen if we extended these sorts of secret trade agreements to the other Asian partners.
No, it's a good point. I'm sure Public Citizen has made something out of it.
An Economy in Crisis again, but it would be great if alternative journalists could find a way to demystify these complex agreements. But again, what role does the Federal Reserve have to do with the perpetuation of losing trade deals?
Well, I don't think that they have much to do with that, actually. The Fed is the most important institution when it comes to employment and unemployment in the United States.
And the trade deals have been losers in employment.
No, that's true. And
not just for us, but also for the so-called winning partners. Korea, with Samsung and Hyundai, you would think they tripled their imbalance of trade to their advantage over us, the United States. We gave them open tariff-free access to the hugest internal market in the world, and what did we get out of it? What can the tiny country of Korea buy from us that would ever make that balance be in our favor? And yet, unions like United Auto Workers supported it, despite the fact that it lost jobs when both Korea and the United States outsourced the work for the new sold cars.
Yes, well, I can't speak for anybody, you know, who endorsed it or why they would do it.
Okay, well, thank you for doing what you've done, and also call people's attention to Monday's Paul Krugman column. He's another free trader that mystifies me, because he's pretty honest in looking at what's been going on in Scandinavia and seeing the difference between how a country like Denmark handles this global situation, the macroeconomic disaster, and how a country like Sweden has handled it. And we've got a political system that doesn't want to even acknowledge that Scandinavian models have brought better lives for their citizens for three decades.
Yes. Well, Well, you do have that in the presidential debate now with Bernie Sanders raising the example of Denmark whenever they ask him about being a socialist.
If he can get into it in a nuanced way, I doubt the media will allow that kind of time.
Well, he has been, he's been talking about it a fair amount, actually, and they've kind of forced him to.
Well, I hope you and Pear keep up this discussion and keep getting into the nuance.
Well, I'd like to continue. Hey, Mark, in your book, you talk about a, you know, another way out of all this, and you you know, you mentioned Argentina. So why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I've, you know, part of the discussion of Argentina has to do with the IMF. There's a chapter in the book on that, the International Monetary Fund. But part of it is to, I give the example of Argentina to show that this, to counter this myth that when you have a financial crisis, and crisis of the banking system, that it necessarily leads to prolonged recession, because that was part of the excuse that we did see in the press for the prolonged slump in Europe, was that, well, this is what happens when you have financial crisis. You have a prolonged period of slow growth and high unemployment. And you can see that Argentina had a very severe financial and banking crisis in 2002. And it was the end of 2001 that they defaulted on their debt. And they devalued their currency, which was at that time fixed to the dollar. And they had a severe crisis and recession, but it only lasted for 3 months. And then they recovered very rapidly over the next 6 years. The economy grew cumulatively by more than 63%. So it is possible to have a rapid recovery, but you have to, first of all, get rid of enough of the debt to allow you to recover. And secondly, if you are stuck in a set of bad macroeconomic policies, especially those that are dictated by unaccountable authorities, in Argentina's case, it was the IMF. In Europe's case, of course, it's the whole group of European authorities. But it is possible to have a fast recovery. And I didn't look only at Argentina. I mean, I looked at all the financial crises associated with devaluations in the past 20 years. You can see that all of them, none of them came anything close to the prolonged, you know, six-year depression that Greece is actually still in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we got another caller on the line. Mark is on the line. Morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a couple of statements. I'm hoping that you might comment, Mark. Number one, Greece and Spain were obedient, and they cut spending, and now they've become colonies. I think the most profitable 11 Greek airports have been privatized. That's the first sentence, the statement. The second is that the rule of Germany and the banks is really the rule of Troika immunization. They're just refusing to accept the fallacy of austerity, and they're shifting responsibility to the working class and the poor and the unemployed. Unemployment is catastrophic throughout Europe, over 10%, maybe even 11%. I'm wondering if you can comment on that, and also if you can comment on the strange double dealing of the IMF, and that they promoted structural adjustment policies, and now they've recognized that that's really a threat to the future and to economic growth.
Yes. Well, first, in terms of what you're saying about Europe, I think it's very true. They are trying to shift the blame on these countries when it's very clear that it's European authorities' policies that have kept unemployment so high, over 24% in Greece right now, and over 22% in Spain. And that's, of course, with many people leaving the country, it would be much both of those countries would be much higher than it is now if so many people hadn't left. Yeah, that has been a terrible failure. Now, the role of the IMF in Europe is similar to what they, it's kind of ironic, because they had played this role in developing countries for decades, and it's, well, I have a chapter in the book about the role of the IMF. And in Europe, it's a little different because, you know, in Europe, the IMF has a board of directors and a board of governors, and so in the case of Europe, the European directors will make the decisions, and that's mostly Germany, but it's the European directors that are making the IMF decisions. So the IMF is not so much of an independent entity in Europe as it is in the middle and low-income countries where the U.S. Treasury Department makes the decisions. But nonetheless, it's a very similar thing. And they have been part of the Troika and or the European authorities, and they have made these decisions to shrink these economies unnecessarily. And I guess the positive part of the story of the IMF in the book is that they have lost influence in the middle-income countries in the 21st century. So they have almost all the middle-income countries that they used to make policy for have escaped from that, and I argue that that was part of the reason that you had a rebound in economic growth in low- and middle-income countries in the 21st century.
How strange it is that the European Central Bank cannot rescue states, that they can only rescue banks. So there must be a real sense that the sovereignty is lost. And to me, the TTIP, the trade agreement, creates a parallel private ad hoc arbitration system of three corporate lawyers, and corporations are able to sue states. States cannot sue corporations. The public is excluded. The arbitration sessions can even take place in hotel rooms, and it's just so scandalous that our sovereignty disappears. That that Obama can't face the reality of NAFTA and the false promises that were made about job creation.
No, it's a very good point you're making about sovereignty, because. And I wanted to, I made this point in the book a couple of places. I wanted to have another chapter on it, and I didn't have the time. But, you know, the Eurozone is an extreme example of countries giving up their sovereignty over the most important economic policies. Now, you can say, okay, well, you know, that's a part of the price of economic integration. But the worst part is that they gave it to people who had, as I described, this horrible political agenda and was not going to use this power over economic decision making, over, you know, monetary exchange rate and ultimately fiscal policy as well, for the benefit of the member states of the Eurozone. And of course, the IMF is another example of that. It's the, you know, the low and middle income countries that have lost sovereignty to the IMF. And so the basic, and then you mentioned, of course, the TTIP, and you could also throw in the TTP and the Trade and International Services Agreement. All three of these agreements are, again, they're an attempt to transfer sovereignty away from governments to these unaccountable international bodies. In this case, the investor-to-state dispute settlement tribunals that you mentioned. And it's exactly the same thing because, you know, the people who are making these agreements, and these agreements are really made directly by corporations. These are writing them, okay? And what they want to do is take all of these policies that were previously seen as the sovereign rights of states to regulate commerce, to regulate food and safety concerns and the environment, and make these into so-called trade issues, intellectual property, patents and copyrights. and call these trade issues and have them to be decided increasingly by these unaccountable tribunals where corporations get to sue governments directly, which they can't even do in the World Trade Organization, for example. So this is a major problem that has to be reversed. And in the book, I talk about this whole set, this ideology, which I call neoliberalism, which I think, you know, we don't use the words here at CBER free market to describe this, because they're not really about free markets. It's really about a set of regressive policies. And, you know, they include these kind of right-wing macroeconomic policies, the independence of central banks, so that independence of central banks become unaccountable, and monetary policy beyond the reach of citizen input or congressional or parliamentary input, and the privatizations, the indiscriminate opening to trade and international capital flows, the deregulation of labor markets. This is a whole set of policies with an ideology that it's wrapped up in. And that's the changes that we've really seen. That's the set of changes that we're looking at in all of these things that we're talking about. And that's what really has to be reversed. And I think some of it was reversed in some countries in the 21st century. And so you are beginning to see it. And, of course, you're seeing much more resistance to these trade agreements, the so-called trade agreements, I would call them commercial agreements, than you've ever had before.
Thanks so
much. I'd like to ask a question. You've written in the past a lot about Venezuela, and we keep reading all sorts of articles in the mainstream media about how bad their economic situation is, which I don't really believe. But can you go into that a little bit?
Well, you know, they've been saying that Venezuela was collapsing and the economy was in terrible shape all through the last 16 years. And now it is actually, you know, even what the old expression, even a stop clock is right twice a day. And so I keep saying, you know, eventually they will have an economic crisis, and they do have one now. There's no doubt about that. Of course, it's always not as bad as they describe it, because they were describing it as horrible even when the economy was booming between, you know, 2003 and 2008. They definitely have serious problems now. The problems are resolvable, though, and I think that's what they don't recognize. They're mainly in the exchange rate system. They have an exchange rate which is not sustainable or feasible. In other words, they're giving away dollars at a price that is way too cheap. And that, of course, feeds into inflation. And then the inflation feeds back into the black market exchange rate. And so you have a kind of inflation depreciation spiral, which has brought inflation to very high levels right now. And the economy is also in recession. But politically, I think you still have a lot of support for the government. You know, you have a hardcore base of Chavistas, and that's because even with the losses of the last couple of years, if you take the whole period of Chavismo, since Chavez was elected and took office in 1999, people, the majority, are still way better off than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's especially compared to the 20 years prior to Chavez, where income per person actually fell.
What about their land reform? You know, they confiscated a lot of land from these big agricultural businesses, and I guess they gave it to the people. What's happened with that? I have been reading about the there's a food sovereignty movement in Venezuela. So that has that been working out? Has that been feeding the people?
Well, there was definitely some land reform, and I don't think that you can't argue, though, that that production overall really increased. But you did get land reform, and you did get more food security in the country, largely because of the the state food stores, and subsidized food, and that's what's protected people. Even though there are long lines and there are shortages, that has protected poor people through this crisis. And of course, the collapse of the price of oil in the last couple of years has not helped either. So, but if you look at the overall statistics, if you look at the period of the last decade from 2004 to 2014, and that's the reasonable period, you can't really count the first 4 years of the government because that was a period in which the opposition controlled the oil industry, and they used it to try and destabilize, wreck the economy, and overthrow the government. And they acknowledged that, of course, it was open. And they did have a military coup in 2002. But if you look at, and you could take it from 2003 if you want, but I look at 2004 because 2003 would be the bottom of recession, so you would be giving too much to the government if you look at the economic growth and progress since then. So if you look at 2004 when the economy caught up with its pre-recession, oil strike recession level of GDP, you see per capita growth of 2% annually from 2004 to 2014, which is pretty good. And you saw a vast reduction in poverty, almost 50%. The official, and that's a poverty rate based just on cash income. And you had a tripling of college enrollment and a huge increase in public pensions. So that's why the government still has some, a fair amount of support, in spite of again the recession and inflation of the last 2 years.
Well, we got another caller on the line. HJ.
Yes.
Okay. Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for having this conversation this morning. I have a question. They talk about a lot of these in the news, but they don't give what they mean. So I want you to explain what this is. And so the question is, what's the meaning of quantitative easing and the meaning of currency manipulation or exchange rate manipulation? I don't get the difference.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, quantitative easing is a policy by which the central bank, for example, the Federal Reserve in the United States, actually creates money and uses it to buy long-term bonds and push down the long-term interest rates. And so that's different from what the Fed normally does with monetary policy. And in its regular monetary policy, which it decides on every 6 weeks, it controls the short-term rate. And it hasn't historically intervened to move long-term rates down. But the Fed did start doing this a few years ago. And so that's the purpose of it, and the main purpose of it is to push down and maintain lower long-term borrowing costs. Currency manipulation, as it's called, is an allegation that's made against certain countries, for example, China, who are accused of keeping their currency lower, and they can do that, of course. They can lower than it would be. The comparison is generally where it would settle in exchange rate markets. So any country can push down the level of its currency simply by printing more of it and selling it. And or in the case of China, the same thing is, buying dollars and accumulating dollars, with its trade surpluses. And the term is kind of political and loaded because obviously any country, many countries do try to control the value of their currency. There's a few countries that actually let their currencies float. The United States is one of them, where it's just our currency is, the price is determined by supply and demand for the dollar primarily. But most countries want to, and I think should, try to control the value of their currency. And so I'm a little more reluctant than others to accuse any particular country of currency manipulation. In the case of China, for example, right now, you can't really accuse them of doing it right now because they're actually going in the opposite direction. They have been spending more than $100 billion a month for the last few months to actually push their currency up. So they're not, in other words, keep it from falling. So they're not manipulating their currency. The manipulation refers to keeping your currency artificially low and pushing it down, which gives you a competitive advantage in international trade. It makes your exports cheaper and your imports more expensive. So they're not doing that now. They're going in the opposite direction. They don't want their currency to fall further at this moment.
Well, we got another caller on the line. Joanne is on the line.
Yeah, hello. I don't keep up with things like other, you know, these big topics and that, like other people, but I've been wondering, is there some kind of organized group or people like in Switzerland or Saudi Arabia or someplace that are deliberately working on keeping the world in chaos, like keeping all, keeping wars always going on, and also deliberately creating refugees to go into other countries like, well, Europe and other places to destroy their sovereignty and to destroy their economic base. Anyway, I'll listen to you. Bye.
Oh, boy, that's a big question.
Well, I don't know how deliberate. I mean, I don't think when the United States bombs Iraq and Syria and Yemen and other countries with planes and drones, and I don't think they're deliberately trying to create refugees, but that is what they do.
Well, yeah, and they talk about creating chaos, somehow, I don't know, making good come out of chaos, but gee whiz, what a night, what a conception.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the refugee problem is primarily a result of the United States military actions, and even ISIS itself probably wouldn't exist if it weren't for what the U.S. government did to that region with the invasion of Iraq and everything else.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you is how much does productivity and growth depend on energy? You know, that seems to be behind a lot of this. I mean, a lot of growth comes out of cheap energy, and of course the energy market now has been kind of really kind of wild. It's been up and down, and it's like as the price of oil goes too high, but now it's too low. I mean, what is going on there?
Well, there's a couple questions there. It is true that all of the things being equal, if you have cheaper energy and you can use it, you will increase productivity. I don't think, but most productivity growth isn't really dependent on falling energy prices. So you do get, for the oil importing countries right now, you get some advantage from the, you know, falling oil prices, and of course it's the opposite for the oil producing crisis. Countries. You're saying what is going on with the markets and for energy. Well, that's always hard. You know, the price of oil is pretty unpredictable. If you look at the forecasts over the last however many decades you want to go back, and you just see what were the economists' forecasts for oil prices and then what happened, there's not a very good relationship. So I think, you know, part of what you're seeing is weak demand in the global economy. Global economic growth is fairly slow right now as compared to a few years ago. And so that lowers the demand for oil. Part of that problem is the what we described in the Eurozone and the weak recovery in the United States. And now more recently, even the Chinese economy is slowing, although slow for them is still about almost 7% growth annually.
Is there a certain amount of growth that's needed in order to have debts be paid? I mean, it seems to me that if there's a very low growth, there wouldn't a lot of debtors, wouldn't they just default?
Well, that is exactly the problem you've had in the Eurozone. You have had default on a good part of the Greek debt, but it is the burden of the debt increases when your economy is not growing. It's much, much harder to pay back debt.
Well, I just wonder if there's some kind of a tipping point or a crashing point where it just becomes totally unsustainable.
Well, yeah, I mean, you did have a world recession, for example, in 2009. You didn't have a lot of defaults on sovereign debt because most countries were still, you know, governments were still solvent. They had reserves, for example. You know, there's a lot of fear about what might happen if the Fed has a sustained rise in interest rates and it pulls money out of emerging market, as they're called, or developing countries. And that's one of the big concerns. It's one of the big concerns that the IMF even has going forward. It's another reason why the Fed shouldn't raise interest rates for the foreseeable future.
Well, that's something we're going to be watching. I hear my music playing, so I want to thank you very much. You've been talking to Mark Weisbrot, economist and author of his most recent book, Failed. Is there a website where we can read your stuff?
Oh, yes, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and it's all up on the web at cepr.net, and there's information there, too, about where to get the book.
Okay, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for KBOO, always something good coming up.
Yes, it's KBOO Portland, and we do have something good coming up at 10:15. Flashpoint today features a Palestinian activist from Jerusalem who works with traumatized children and women there. Also today, hundreds of Korean families, separated for more than 60 years, are briefly reunited. We'll hear the co-founder of the national campaign to end the Korean War. And at 11 on Between the Covers, we speak with T. Geronimo Johnson about his novel, Welcome to Braggsville. And at 11:30, the film show honors Future Day, as envisioned in Back to the Future Part 2, with a classic 2011 K-Boo conversation with actor, author, and independent filmmaker Crispin Glover. That's all coming up after Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary, right up next on K-Boo. Thank you, K-Boo members. Your support keeps this station operating. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Health Club's Body Positive Block Party, Thursday, October 22nd at Health Club in Portland. The Body Positive Block Party is an inaugural bash for Portland's first body positive, worker-owned, community-centered barbell gym. Again, that's the Body Positive Block Party on Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at Health Club, 1235 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.